Hello, and welcome to Specimen Stories. My name is Clara Nordén. In this podcast, I explore some of the amazing and surprising finds that emerge from natural history collections. If you've visited a natural history museum, you've probably been astonished by the displays of animals and fossils in the exhibitions. But these displayed specimens form only a small fraction of the total collections contained in a natural history museum. Large museums, such as the Smithsonian, have millions of specimens in their collections that are not on display, ranging from jars with preserved fish to taxidermy birds and fossil dinosaur bones. These collections form a record of the diversity of life on Earth and are an invaluable resource for scientists. But what exactly can we learn from natural history collections? What stories do the specimens tell us? In this series, we meet the scientists working with specimens and learn about the scientific discoveries they made working in the collections. Join me in exploring the hidden world of specimens. A lot of us don't spend a lot of time thinking about fish. In fact, though many enjoy a view of the sea, few think much about the entire world that exists beneath the water surface. Yet there are more fish species than there are mammals, reptiles, birds, and amphibians combined, about 32,000 species. There is a fish species that lives for 400 years. There is a fish species where the male gets pregnant instead of the female. There is a fish species that generates electricity. There is even a fish that breathes air. How did all this weird and wonderful diversity evolve? That's the question that captivates Corey Evans, assistant professor at Rice University. Corey is especially interested in how the skulls of fish have evolved over time. How do really novel, strange skull shapes evolve? For example, how do you evolve to have the entire right side of your face moving to the left side? Seems like a pretty outlandish thing to do, but yes, you guessed it, there is a fish that does that. In this episode, we'll learn much more about how the humble flatfish achieves this feat, and what this can tell us about how extraordinary life forms evolve. Welcome to Specimen Stories, Corey. It's great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with a basic question. Why are fish such an interesting group of organisms to study?
Ah, that is a great question. So fish are an exciting group of organisms to study for, I guess, a ton of reasons. One of the reasons is that there's so many of them. So there are over 30,000 species of ray fin fish, teleost fish. And that is more, so if you combine all that diversity, there are more fish in the sea than there are vertebrates all over else on the planet. So there are more fish than there are vertebrates. And fish aren't just kind of exceptional in the numbers game. Fish are doing things with their bodies and their ecologies that really kind of go beyond the human imagination. So oftentimes when people are talking about dinosaurs, and because there's a lot of attention about dinosaurs, oftentimes kind of point out that fishes alive today are, you know, so bizarre and so kind of captivating that they do things that, you know, even a dinosaur can't even imagine, right? So if you look at the span of morphological diversity that we've seen across, you know, some of our terrestrial vertebrates, what fish are doing today is still far, far beyond any of that. So it's kind of crazy. So yeah, fish are awesome.
So what you're saying basically is that for anyone who's really fascinated by T-Rex or Spinosaurus or Triceratops, these familiar dinosaurs, they should really just be looking more closely at fish.
Yeah, because, I mean, look, you know, T-Rex never lived inside of a hydrothermal vent.
No, that's very true.
Yes.
I guess when I was a kid, I was really into dinosaurs, and that was one of my main paths into natural science. But I'm curious how you got interested into studying fish. So how did that start for you? Were you really into fish already as a child?
So I too was into dinosaurs. I still like dinosaurs. I think they're great. But when I was, I think I was about 14, and I was in high school at the time, and I was actually failing a bunch of classes. So I had to take summer school. And while I was in summer school, my parents grounded me because, of course. So while I was grounded, I wasn't able to like go outside. So I started keeping fish tanks in my room to keep myself sane. And after that, I started, you know, like taking notes on the fish behavior, and I started, you know, mixing and matching fishes in the tank. And it went from, you know, one tank in my bedroom to about seven. So I, since like age 14, I was pretty into fish. And by age 15, I was like, oh, maybe I'll be a marine biologist. So, yeah.
Wow, that's probably one of the most productive times being grounded I have ever heard of.
This is true.
Basically, it was laying the groundwork for you becoming an assistant professor in fish biology at Rice University, which you are now.
Yep, the groundworks.
Yep, precisely. So you were growing up and you had all these fish tanks, which kind of started your fascination with the diversity of fish, their shape and behaviors. But at some point, your interest transitioned to a very particular type of diversity within fish, which is focused on the diversity of skull shapes. How did that interest come about? Why are skull shapes such an interesting part of the fish to study?
So the skull is one of the most recognizable features in the vertebrate body plan, right? So for the most part, if I showed you like the back end of almost any vertebrate versus the skull, you'd probably have a better chance of figuring out what it is that you're looking at if you're looking at the skull. And that's not necessarily by accident. The skull does a ton of things, right? It's super multifunctional. I'm using my skull to talk to you while looking at you, while listening to you all at the same time. And if I had like a snack here, I would be eating, and you know, and I'm thinking thoughts. So, the skull is a super multifunctional structure. And one of the cool things about the vertebrate skull is that, you know, all vertebrates have it, which means that you can trace the evolutionary transitions of the skull back to a single common ancestor and see how it's changed across the entire vertebrate diaspora, which is very, very exciting. And fish in particular, again, do completely wacky things with their skulls. So I love all skulls, to be clear, but the fish skull is wild, right? It's super kinetic. It's composed of over 100 bones. Like half of those bones are completely movable, and they can be translated in real time. And fish suction feeding is this very, very dynamic process where they basically throw half of their face at a prey item to generate a suction force to bring it to their face. So what fishes have done in particular with us, with their skulls, is rather exciting. And every time I think I've, you know, like maybe run out of a good idea, I'll see a fish on Twitter or something like, man, how did we get there? Like, how did that show up? So, yeah.
I mean, in a sense, that's the base question of all good evolutionary biology. You look at a weird organism and you ask yourself, how on earth did we get here? So maybe to you, other vertebrate skulls are actually quite boring because they don't do as many different things as fish skulls do. So could you explain a little bit how fish skulls differ from other vertebrate skulls?
Yes, right. So humans and all of the tetrapods, for that matter, they only have like one set of jaws, for example. Like fish oftentimes have two sets of jaws in their throat. So it's not just the moray. Hold on a minute.
They have two sets of jaws?
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, like the movie Alien, where there was like a little jaw that came out of the big jaw?
Yes.
If you've ever seen that, yeah. So fish, many fish species do that as well. So they have basically evolved the second set of jaws to either transport prey from the front of their mouth to their throat, like moray eels, or they use it to, they'll like swallow a clam or something and crush it up in their throat.
Wow, that really is pretty wild.
Yeah, it's wild, right? And like fishes do that just like casually.
Yeah, that brings us pretty nicely into our next topic. So I wanted to talk a little bit about evolutionary novelty. So I guess you could say that these two jaws that these some kinds of fishes have to catch prey is one type of evolutionary novelty. But let's talk a little bit more about exactly what this concept means, what novelty means in evolution, and why are people so interested in the evolutionary novelty, including yourself?
Right. So that's a great question. And so evolutionary novelty and innovation is something that I've gotten into fairly recently, as I've kind of been understanding how different clades have colonized different areas of trait space and things like that. But an evolutionary novelty is really just a new trait that allows an organism to do something that it was unable to do before. So that's a novelty. And innovation is oftentimes like a suite of novelties that get clustered together that allow, that basically change the game, right? It like changes the ecological landscape that an organism or a clade of organisms inhabits. So like an evolutionary novelty could be like a spine, on a new spine in the cheek of a fish, right? Like its ancestors didn't have that spine, now it does. That's new. And evolutionary innovation would be like flight.
Right. Right. That's a really big one.
That's a game changer. Or asymmetry in flatfishes.
Yeah, we'll get into talking about the flatfishes in a moment. But first, could you explain why people are so interested in understanding evolutionary novelty and innovation?
Yeah. So oftentimes the study of evolution, especially in the way it's been conducted in the past, is where oftentimes humans are trying to figure out what makes humans humans, right? And if you look at humans compared to their closest extant relatives, we're pretty different from chimps. And even if you throw in our fossil, you know, our fossil ancestors, humans are still pretty odd, right? And humans are oftentimes like a walking suite of evolution innovations. And we're not the only ones that have innovated, right? So other clades, other organisms have innovated. So if we can understand how the innovation process happened in these other clades, we might have a better idea of how it happened for us.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So I guess in thinking about how these evolutionary novelties first arise, perhaps the most familiar thought is to think about a change in the environment that causes the organism to change in some way. So if we build on our examples with the humans here, our ancestors perhaps became bipedal because there was something in their environment that changed. So perhaps instead of being in a forest, we now had open landscapes and they needed to be bipedal to move efficiently in that environment. So that's a kind of outside factor that causes an evolutionary innovation to appear, in this case, bipedalism. And this is, of course, a ground tenet of evolution, that you adapt your environment. But of late, people have become really interested as well in what kind of intrinsic factors might cause or limit an organism to adapt to its environment in some cases. So what are meant with these intrinsic factors, and how do they differ from the extrinsic factors, the factors in the environment?
Yeah, so extrinsic factors generally refer to things like the environment and how the environment might shape the form of an organism. So there have been a lot of experiments where if you raise a fish in fast flowing water, they get like more slender fusiform bodies, things like that. Where the opposite, extrinsic, this refers to some of the developmental or genetic factors that might constrain or facilitate how an organism can respond to environmental stimuli. So my guess is that if you raised every fish species in fast-flowing water, not all of them would turn into fusiform, would get fusiform bodies, because some of their genetic programming isn't that flexible or doesn't allow them to vary in those directions. So those are some of the intrinsic properties that I'm really interested in.
Right. So the various genes that exist in a group of fish, or perhaps their developmental program, how they develop, may allow them or restrict them to travel down certain evolutionary paths, different ways to evolve. And we're going to go a little bit further down the rabbit hole here and thinking about how different organisms evolve and how novelties evolve. So there are two big words involved here in describing how some organisms may be more constrained or less constrained in evolving novelty. And those are modularity and integration. Corey, can you help us unpack what these two terms mean and how they relate to evolutionary novelty?
Yeah, for sure. Let's get into it. I love this stuff. All right. So integration occurs when there's a high degree of what's called covariation between traits or trait complexes. So basically, there's a shared genetic network, signaling network, underlying these two traits. So that if you have a change or a mutation occurs in one trait complex, you expect it to be reflected in another. At macroevolutionary timescales over deep time, this basically couples traits and allows them to evolve together in concert. The opposite, or not really the opposite, but I would argue a special case of integration is modularity. Modularity occurs where there's a low degree of covariation between trait complexes, but a high degree of integration within each individual trait complex. So basically, if a mutation occurs over here, in trait one, you don't necessarily expect it to be reflected in trait two due to a breakdown in that signaling network ultimately. And across deep macroevolutionary timescales, this allows these two traits to behave semi-autonomously, which is exciting because now they don't have to worry about, you know, what if I get a mutation over here, does it have to be beneficial for this trait in order for it to stick? They can actually behave semi-autonomously and respond separately to different selective stimuli. So modularity gets a lot of attention because you can get these cool patterns like mosaic evolution where different traits across an organism are evolving at different rates. And it's kind of, it's a really exciting, you know, topic to study. And integration, on the other hand, is generally considered to constrain patterns of macroevolution because if you have too many traits that are linked together in a network, it becomes really hard to find, you know, one mutation that's beneficial across all of them. So this creates evolutionary inertia.
Right. So that's super interesting, but kind of a lot for me to take in. So let me just summarize it shortly and you can tell me if I've gotten it right. So if we have a fish and it has, say, two different traits, like the length of the jaw and the size of the eye. And then if the eye size and the jaw length could evolve completely independently, so the eye could become really large and the jaw really short, or vice versa, or any combination thereof, then we're talking about modularity. But on the other hand, if this fish was kind of constrained in the sense that it could only evolve, if it was evolving larger eyes, it was simultaneously evolving a longer jaw. And if the eye was growing smaller, the jaw would go shorter. Then we're talking about integration. Is that correct?
Correct.
Great. So you also mentioned that there is this bigger idea that modularity would allow organisms to evolve more novelty because they can literally evolve in any direction. They can kind of mix and match their traits as they like, if you will. Whereas integration, on the other hand, could constrain organisms because they can only evolve according to certain paths in evolutionary space or in the kind of morphological diversity that they can achieve. So you were really interested in testing this idea in fish skulls and seeing whether modularity actually was allowing fish to evolve in weirder ways. And you chose flatfish to ask this question. So can you tell us a little bit more about flatfish and why there was such a great group of fish to study for this?
So flatfishes were a great group for a number of reasons. So flatfishes, if you've ever seen them, they are highly asymmetrical. And they are, in fact, the most asymmetrical vertebrate on the planet. One eye has basically moved to the other side of its head. So now you have two eyes sitting on like one side of the animal. And now it lays on its side. And it lives on the bottom of the seafloor. They are bizarre creatures. And this weirdness, as you can imagine, has, you know, wreaked like havoc on how on our understanding of the homology of the skull bones and all kinds of crazy things. So the flatfish, for me, flatfishes were actually kind of a big challenge. And I was like, I had moved through the electrofish world and kind of done the electrofish skull thing. And I was, you know, I was feeling myself. I was like, well, I wonder if I can tackle this flatfish challenge. And the fun thing about flatfish is that their sister taxa, their I guess closest relatives, are obviously not asymmetrical, and they're also super. They're this gigantic mega clade of really weird fishes in their own right. Right? You have remoras, you have swordfish, you have barracuda, mahi mahi, jacks. You have some really insane fish just sitting right next to them. So to me, that entire clade called the Karangaria, that was just a really interesting clade to study. And flatfishes in and of themselves were odd, but I really just wanted to study all of them. And so that's why I started it. And then I had this theory, me and some of my collaborators had this theory that maybe the orbital migration that flatfishes experience evolutionarily might have been a modular process. Because, you know, if you're just looking at the flatfish skull, all you really see is, and you're looking at kind of a fossil time series, what you really see is just the eye kind of gradually migrating to the other side of the head.
Let's just pause for a minute and think about how weird it is that in flatfish, the eye just migrates to the other side of the face. So is there any other organism that does this?
Not that I know of. Oh, sorry. There is.
There is?
So my friend Chris Martinez linked up with Melius Diazny and described this new species of what's called a mud eel that does have asymmetry where one eye is moved to the other side. We know nothing about the mud eel otherwise.
Well, of course, it would have to be another fish species if it's happened in any other organism. More crazy cranial morphology. But from the perspective of the flatfish, this weird adaptation allows them to hide really well on the seafloor because they can bury under the sand and be almost invisible. So that's kind of the function of being flat for the flatfish. But you may still ask, well, why did they choose this very particular way of becoming flat when they could have just flattened in many other ways that didn't involve moving their eye or moving parts of their face? So that was really the question you wanted to answer. And the thought here is that maybe modularity could have played a role in facilitating this weird adaptation. So to answer that question, you needed to measure the shape variation of many different types of or species of flatfish and their relatives and compare it. How did you go about doing that?
That is a good question. One of the methods that I use is called geometric morphometrics. So it allows me to quantify the shape of an object, basically. And I guess in the olden times, if we wanted to describe how something was shaped, you'd use your words. You'd say, okay, well, that is a triangle. And that is obviously a square because I say so. And geometric morphometrics gives you the ability to put like kind of hard actual numbers on it by comparing what are called homologous landmarks. So you just put landmarks on the same homologous structures or the same structures that correspond between specimens. So if I say I want a landmark on the eye, on the left eye, you just find the left eye of all the specimens. And you can see how the position of that landmark varies. So if you were to take, I think I had 200 landmarks for each flatfish skull. If you were to take 200 landmarks and run it across, you know, all the species in Karangaria, you can have a pretty good idea of how skull shape is changing across this clade, which is exciting. So basically what we did was we came up with a landmark scheme. I took a trip to University of Michigan because they have an insane fish collection. And me and Matt Friedman teamed up. And I think I camped out at his house for like a week, and we just micro CT scanned fish after fish after fish. And it was really cool because we would scan these fish, and the scanner was really fast. I think in 20 minutes, you could see the whole scan. It was like, and it was funny. It was like two fish nerds in like a dark room, just like shrieking at screens for like a week. It was awesome. And that was how I got all the non-flatfish Karangaria. And then I went to Friday Harbor and for the summer, and I had an RU student working with me who's also a co-author on the paper. We teamed up and we continued to just scan every flatfish we could get our hands on. Most of them came from museum collections.
Right. So you were creating this really cool data set of 3D models of fish skulls from the flatfish and their relatives using preserved fish specimens, which I imagine are these jars of preserved whole fish. Is that correct? What do these specimens look like?
Yeah, so these fishes are preserved in ethanol, basically. They were fixed in formalin, and then they were moved to ethanol for long-term storage. So basically these fishes are fixed in ethanol, and they're housed in these museum collections across the country. You can actually, Google search different ichthyology or different museum collections and request specimens to be mailed to you. And once you get them there, depending on what permissions you have from the curators or from the collections managers, you can collect all types of data on them.
Yeah, and I think CT scanning is a really good example of how some new and modern techniques can help us get even more information from these sometimes really old specimens that people probably at the time when they collected these fish could have never imagined. So even though these fish are preserved whole within those jars, you can actually extract a 3D model of the internal skeletal morphology using micro CT. So that's really cool and exciting. And it must have been really quite the thrill for you to just, you know, put in these flatfish specimens in the scan and then seeing live how this weird internal cranial shape was appearing on your computer screen as you were scanning it.
Yeah, because you never really knew what you were going to get, because like you could look at a flatfish and then scan it and it'd be like the inside would be nothing that you thought, right? Some of them have like little horns coming off of their near cranium because their like dorsal fin comes out over the face. So they've grown like an extension like just out of their forehead. It's absurd.
Wow, that's really amazing. So let's return now to your original question. So you had this data set of flatfish skull morphology, and you had analyzed the shape variation across different skulls using landmarks, as we discussed earlier. What did you find when you analyzed these data? Were there signs for modularity driving the extreme skull shapes in flatfishes?
Yeah, so I was actually very, very surprised at first when I ran this analysis. So I ran it like a dozen times. So one of the things I was interested in was modularity, but then I was interested in rates of evolution. So flatfishes get a lot of attention because of their orbital migration. So I figured at first that the orbit would be evolving faster than maybe other regions of the skull. And because of this, these hypothesized mosaic patterns of evolution, I figured that you might find like a lot of modularity across the flatfish skull. We did not find that, which was really, really odd. And it was because we were kind of only thinking about one region of the flatfish skull without bringing it all together. So what we actually found was that the evolution of the flatfish skull was an integrated process across the entire nerve cranium. So basically, as the eye migrated in evolution and also in development, it coincided with changes all across the face. In addition to moving the orbit, you also kind of have the otoliths that shift in position. The supraoccipital crest will kind of move as well to like track where the muscles are inserting across the skull. And so it's actually a global process across the skull, which we frankly did not appreciate before the study.
That's really interesting because it goes kind of against the prediction you had at the start, where maybe modularity or the flatfish skull would be more modular and this would help these extreme morphologies to evolve. But quite to the contrary, it seemed like the integration across the flatfish skull was actually helping really fast evolutionary rates or fast rates of change. Is that correct?
That is correct. So it's really interesting. So in modern like derived flatfishes, we get a ton of different adaptations that coincided with the evolution of integration. However, there's one family of flatfishes that is the earliest branching lineage of flatfishes that is thought to possess the more ancestral phenotypes. So these fish they're asymmetrical, but their eyes haven't migrated all the way over to the other side of their head. They're pigmented on both sides. They look like, for all intents and purposes, they look like a regular fish with just a weird face. And so the next question that I'm interested in asking is whether or not the initial kind of asymmetry process, whether or not there was a modularity, whether that was kind of facilitated by modularity that was later swept together with these other traits that later became integrated, or whether or not it was just always integrated from the beginning.
So like so often in science, they may not be entirely black and white, all modularity or all integration, but perhaps a little bit of both.
Likely a little bit of both. I think there might have been like a stepwise pattern or stepwise process to get there.
Still, the really surprising results you found in flatfish with integration having such a big role, it makes you wonder if the same is true in other groups, maybe other fish, or perhaps even other groups of organisms, so for example, birds and so on. Does integration play a role in driving evolutionary innovation in those clades as well?
Yeah, so it's coming out over the last, I want to say 3 years, it's actually coming out that integration is really a major player here. And integration isn't just constraining things. So birds in particular are super integrated. So bird brains are integrated, bird beaks and skulls are often highly integrated as well. The same could be said for squamates. So like reptiles and things, those are, what we found is that they exhibit very conserved patterns of integration, despite being very morphologically diverse. You know, you go from snakes to lizards to whatever else is in squamates. I can't remember right now. Maybe like amphisbanians, right? And they all have very conserved patterns of integration across their skulls, which is really kind of impressive because for us, we thought that integration was constraining things. And yet we see that we've actually gotten a ton of diversity all while being fairly integrated. And in other fish clades that I've looked at so far, we're looking at wrasses, we're looking at parrotfishes. We found kind of the same thing, that either integration patterns don't change at all or things might become slightly more integrated.
That's really interesting. So how can we make sense of that? Because before we talked about how modularity may allow the evolution of really diverse forms because you could kind of mix and match traits however you wanted and evolve in any direction, whereas integration may be constraining the number of different ways you can evolve in. So how can we understand how integration may actually facilitate the evolution of novelty?
That's a great question. So have you ever heard of the expression herding cats?
No, actually.
So if you try to herd cats, you can imagine how that would go. It would go very, very poorly. And the reason why is because cats are all these like semi-autonomous, very independent thinking creatures that really do not want to do what you tell them to do. So if you're trying to, say if you're trying to like march somewhere, trying to get to a destination, and evolution isn't necessarily a destination-driven process, but say if you're just trying to move 10 feet and you want to move all your cats 10 feet, it's going to be very, very hard because they're going to be going everywhere. So oftentimes I view modularity as kind of a herding cats process where, you know, you might occupy quite a bit of morpho space because your cats are everywhere, but if you need to mount a response to a selective pressure, it will be very, very difficult because your cats will not listen to you. I think integration helps in mounting responses to strong selective pressures where modularity might not necessarily be able to.
That is such a great analogy. I love thinking about modularity as herding cats. Definitely a very inefficient way to move in a particular direction fast.
Yeah, and studies have shown in short periods of time that when species are encountering really variable climates, they become kind of less integrated to explore possible like trait solutions or possible adaptive solutions. And then when the climates become more stable, they integrate.
Wow, that's really fascinating. And it suggests to me too that perhaps by understanding more about the integration or modularity of different systems of different organisms, can help us predict or perhaps understand how different groups of organisms are likely to respond to a rapidly changing world, which is something we're experiencing at the moment. So you've really given me a lot to think about here, and it's been such an interesting discussion. Seeing how we can get these kind of bigger insights into how evolution proceeds from studying one group of weird fish, the flatfishes. But it also makes me really curious about what other wonders are out there to be discovered in fish collections. So, Corey, if you were to take us on a tour of the fish collections, which shelf would you take us to? Which fish would you show us? And what would we see?
Man, that's a tough one. Oh, man. And I feel like I'll give you an answer and then I'll regret whatever I tell you in like 20 minutes. So, okay. Let's see. Say I wanted to take you all to a weird place in a fish collection. Oh, I would totally have to take you to the South American or Amazonian fish section, because those things are bizarre. We all know about deep sea fish, or a lot of us know about deep sea fish. We know those things are weird, but a lot of those South American fish are pretty odd. Especially, I got my dissertation working on the electric fish in the Amazon, and those things are weird. They've got these long faces, sometimes these teeny tiny eyes, and they barely look like fish, frankly. So I'd probably take you there, and then if I can add another place, I would probably actually just take you to the flatfish section for sure. Yeah.
So plenty of fascinating fish to explore in the fish collections. Sounds like quite the place for inspiration.
It's totally a place of inspiration. Back when I worked in a museum collection, I would just go down there and hang out.
That's great. And thanks to you, Corey, for sharing a little bit of the science that came out of perhaps one of these inspirational moments in the fish collections. It's been really great to have you on the show. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to you for tuning into this episode of Specimen Stories. Head over to the show website to learn more about fish collections and Corey's research at claranorden.com/specimenstories. This episode was recorded and produced by me, Clara Nudien, and the music was downloaded from purpleplanet.com and pixabay.com. If you liked the show or have any thoughts or comments you'd like to share with me, let me know at specimenstoriespodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, goodbye.